right, why don't we go ahead and get started? My name is Carla Sewell, and I teach at Luther College. I teach areas primarily of Hebrew Bible and Judaism. And I do a lot of work in the area of interreligious dialogue. And that's what we've been taking a look at this week, the whole idea of religious pluralism in America, and some, especially the kinds of conflicts and problems that emerge in the United States in particular, where we have one of the most diverse nations in the world. And we have people from around the world living here from many different faith traditions, languages, and cultures. And those things are sometimes bound to create conflict. We're not focusing on all of the ways that diversity or pluralism can create conflict, but we're looking in particular at religiously oriented conflict when we have these different pieces. Throughout the week, we've kind of been taking a look at a spectrum of different case studies. So from Monday, the most extreme, starting with a murder in Mesa, Arizona of a Sikh. It was the first revenge killing after 9/11, and a Sikh was mistaken for a Muslim and killed. And in some ways, when I say that, I always have to say, but it wouldn't have mattered if it was a Muslim either. This person, regardless, would have had nothing to do with 9/11, sort of that vigilante sort of thinking. We move from there to take a look at the National Day of Prayer and some of the obstacles that creates, an instance in Troy, Michigan. And that was, you know, sort of a national issue. There's National Day of Prayer throughout the nation, and so many communities might be experiencing those same kinds of conflicts. Yesterday, we got more regional, right? Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport and Somali Muslim taxi drivers who, on the basis of their faith, refused to transport passengers who were carrying alcohol. Today, we're going to get a little bit more local yet. A lot of the things that we've been taking a look at have been happening sort of in public space. So the National Day of Prayer on the Veterans Plaza of City Hall in Troy, Michigan, Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport, you know, kind of like the idea of a bus station, a civic spot. People have to go through there. Today we're going to bring this local to the local faith communities, synagogues, churches, mosques, other sorts of local institutions where some of that engagement between religious traditions are happening. And perhaps this would be the setting that most of us might find ourselves in or could see ourselves in. Tomorrow, the last day, we're going to do, I think it's the 10:50 in the morning slot, instead of a case study, we're going to try to pull a lot of this stuff together and try to construct a perspective of the household. What does it mean for people of all these different traditions, religious and otherwise, to live together? Right? And we're going to be using that, like I said, the idea of the household, quoting from Martin Luther King Jr., who talked about all of us living, we've inherited this great household, and we have no choice but to figure out how we live together. How we do so is what will help us survive and thrive. So we'll take a look at some images for constructing positive interreligious encounters tomorrow. But today, I'd like to start out with the idea, since with all this diversity in the United States, there's a lot more, and we talked about this throughout the week in the conversations that people have had and when they've raised their hands, people finding themselves in the worship space of a tradition that is not their own. Whether it's through a wedding, something like a bar bat mitzvah, maybe a funeral, maybe being invited to a service of some type, or inviting a friend of yours, one of those sorts of things. So we're doing a lot more going back and forth between our religious traditions. And so they're coming into the spaces that had formerly, in some ways, been pretty sort of exclusive, all right? You're a member, you belong here, or you're interested in being a member, and you come here. There wasn't a lot of going back and forth. But today, in any given city in particular. You could go into a synagogue and have a variety of Christians or Muslims or Hindus visiting for whatever reason, and it can happen in that way in any religious tradition. If they were to walk into a, if let's say, a Jewish individual were to be worshiping in a Christian church, all right, which is more and more common, especially with interfaith marriages and a lot more going back and forth within the Jewish and Christian communities, and this gospel is read, and let's say you've brought your Jewish friend with you, your Jewish relative, and the pastor gets up to read the gospel and says, you know, the word of the Lord, and starts, "But woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you lock people out of the kingdom of heaven, for you do not go in yourselves, and when others are going in, you stop them. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees," over and over and over again. Or it could be from the Gospel of John that says, "Jews, Jews, Jews." You might be getting kind of itchy in your seat. All right. I went to a conference earlier, a couple of years ago, and there's a Jewish professor at Vanderbilt who teaches New Testament. Her name is Amy Jill Levine. And she said that in Nashville, where Vanderbilt is, in the Jewish community there, she brought her child's youth group. They were doing the study of other religious traditions, and she brought their youth group into a Christian church. I believe it was Methodist. And so we just happened to have a Methodist hymnal here in the library. And this is a song that's familiar to many Lutherans and many Christians, regardless of the grouping. And she said they all had their hymnals and they started singing, and then they had to turn to page 261. And so these Jewish kids are trying to figure out how to work the hymnal as opposed to the prayer book from their synagogue. So they turned to 261, "Lord of the Dance." Started singing. "I danced in the morning when the world was begun," and I went through that. Verse 2, "I danced for the scribe and the Pharisee, but they would not dance and they would not follow me. I danced for the fishermen, for James and John, they came to me and the dance went on. I danced on the Sabbath when I cured the lame, the holy people said it was a shame. They whipped and they stripped and they hung me on high and they left me up there on the cross to die." The kids turned to her and said, "Amy, are they talking about us?" This is a conference, primarily a homiletics preaching conference that I had attended to kind of look at how the scripture was used in preaching. And you could see, and it was primarily Christians, and you could see every pastor in there go, "Oh." But it's, and the funny thing is, most people in there, it had never occurred to before. It's not in the Lutheran hymnals, but Lutherans know this hymn. Do people know Lord of the Dance? Have you heard the song? Yeah. After she said that at that conference, I can't even do the song. Because the kid, and here you have these kids saying, "Is that us? Are they singing that about us? Do they believe that? Do they believe that?" She said, "Well, we'll have to talk about this afterwards." And, you know, there's a lot of discussion and realizing, yeah, some, you know, in terms of what do they believe? What does that mean? If Christians all around the United States are singing that and reading this, right? So when we invite people into our worship spaces, and there's a lot of traffic between worship spaces, you run into some conflicts. Things about your own community that you never would have thought about before all of a sudden become sort of glaringly obvious when you bring in the other into your midst. Yeah.
I'm curious, maybe this is off topic. If I were to go to synagogue, I know there's a variety of synagogues, there would be nothing in particular that doesn't exist within the Jewish tradition, these sort of blame casting.
There is one prayer, and it is called, kind of like, in Hebrew, the minim, and it's kind of like the curses on, but it's not used.
Okay.
The one that is used in more traditional Jewish settings, but the Reform has changed it, even the conservative movement has changed the language, is the one, "Thank God I'm not a woman," or "I wasn't born a woman," so, you know, but even some of those. But yeah, no, there isn't anything comparable. There just isn't the comparable piece.
If you were Egyptian,
if you're Egyptian, in terms of walking into some of those texts. Yeah, and it could be in some ways.
I don't want to be weird about this. I understand the point, but it just seems you got to understand history and context. It'd be like if I invited someone to my house and I was watching the History Channel and was talking about how bad Germans were during World, you know, the Nazi movement was. Am I afraid I'm going to offend a German who's in my house?
You know, and I do buy that to some extent because I think it's all about context. However, after now 8 years of teaching Judaism at Luther, most of my students have never met a Jewish person, and I ask what stereotypes they have of Jews. It's down the line from the Gospels. They take them from the text. There's no contextualizing.
And to support that, I'm a history teacher, and I have German students. They're very uncomfortable when I teach World War II. And even though it's history in very certain context, I'm very careful to separate Nazis from Germans, it's very tough for them. Because the reaction of the other kids is, they don't know the other kids' reaction, how they see them. So, I mean,
context is great, but the Egyptians aren't showing up in every Sunday's gospel, and we don't sing about them in the same way. You find in the Hebrew Bible readings, but Egypt isn't really where Egypt shows up in the New Testament is where Jesus flees there for safety, and then comes back.
It's a whole different
system. Yeah, it's like a different system. So in some ways, that sort of, you're right. If there were a whole bunch of Canaanites out there, there would be a problem. But they don't. The only living group remaining from biblical context in terms of that has had more, a more continuous existence is that of the Jewish people. And a lot of those stereotypes, I was shocked to find, because my first sense, well, it's context, you got it. They're not buying. I do it in adult forums. I do stereotypes, you know, in terms of just what comes to your mind. And those are the things that are, and they come directly from our hymnody, our prayers, and our texts. So, yes, so what, you know, what do you, and people say the automatic need then is for more education. Yes, there is. However, that doesn't stop some of these, you know, where these things become more obvious is when you do have this sort of cross-fertilization of people visiting each other, all right? How do you act as a host in that situation? How do you sort of explain it away? Or is that what we're intended to do? You know, and anyway, what I'm saying is it's a thorny issue, all right? And that's not just to say Christians are the only ones with thorny issues. The one today is set in a Jewish synagogue, and the case study that we're going to be taking a look at, which I think is kind of interesting. The setting for today is Sharon, Massachusetts, 2004. So a lot of these case studies are within the last 4 or 5 years, and they've been updated to do kind of follow-up up through 2007, I think. So in the Anti-Defamation League, identify this town as a site for sort of a pilot interfaith group because Sharon was growingly diverse, had a large Jewish population, a new huge mosque was built right near this area, so growing with Muslims, it was very much a growing and diverse area. So a Jewish woman from the conservative movement named Janet Penn was selected to coordinate that effort. And she herself, in some of these case studies, they provide some personal background. She grew up not particularly observant, all right?
So
she grew up not so observant in her household. So she ate pork and all these other sorts of things. And she wasn't like a regular synagogue goer. It was more of a cultural sort of thing. And in that setting, but as an adult, she kind of did some searching and settled in the conservative movement, became very much more active and raised her children that way. She didn't have experience in interfaith work, but she did have some other credentials which would lend themselves to this, an MBA and a master's social work, and a lot of work in nonprofit organizations, so a lot of working with people from diverse groups, that sort of thing. So by 2004, she'd established Interfaith Action. It's an independent group. It's for teens, and it's now in other locations. But this Interfaith Action group had 50 student members from many of the different religious traditions. So they had Hindu students and Jewish students and Christian students and Muslim students, a whole range in this in the city of Sharon. In 2007, this interfaith action group of teens decided to put together a community meal. And this, if you take a look at the case study part, Penn and these teenagers were working on a dinner because the Jewish high holidays and the Muslim holy month of Ramadan coincided, and it would not happen again for another 30 years. So they thought this is a really great opportunity to kind of celebrate some of these key holidays together. So, and the teens together worked to figure out a name, and they called it Sharing Sacred Seasons. And they'd invited Jews, Muslims, Hindus, Christians, and other neighbors from religious traditions. And they were expecting about 400 people to come to this event. As they were getting ready for this event, Penn, along with some of the teens, and they were going to hold it at the Temple Israel, the synagogue there, and they saw, all of a sudden, you're kind of looking at the synagogue in sort of a new way, because this is Penn's home synagogue. She looked at it and was like, oh my gosh, right in the entryway is a big prominent sign that says, we support Israel. Now, many Muslims would be coming to this, all right? Recently, right previous to this, in the like previous 2 years or so, a popular imam, Muslim imam in the city of Sharon, had been arrested for suspected terrorism. It turns out that he had nothing to do with terrorism. Oh, he and his son were arrested. They had nothing to do with terrorism, but it shook the community, and he was known for his interfaith work. And so Muslims there were feeling pretty edgy. In addition, as I had mentioned, a new mosque had opened. This is outside of Boston, and there was a lot of tension around the neighbors. They didn't want a mosque in their neighborhood. And so there were protests. So there was this sense by Muslims, and again, after 9/11, you know, all these things are sort of piling on. And so there was a lot of insecurity in that community, and partly because they'd been so targeted. At any rate, knowing all of a sudden, she looked at that sign differently. And many of the teens, because they were looking at that, oh no. What this means to us may be taken to mean something completely different to our Muslim guests. Right, sort of what is central to kind of our community's action and focus could be to them a slap in the face, especially due to the Israel-Palestinian situation. So they kind of thought about what to do about that, and she talked to the teens, and they finally, it's like, okay, I think we need to talk to the rabbi. Went and talked to the rabbi at the synagogue, and he decided on the spot, after hearing from the students, that they could take the sign down for this event. He said, we're inviting guests in. He said, this event isn't about politics. It's about spirituality, us meeting, and we're inviting them into our home. And it is our responsibility to make them feel welcome. All right. And he also realized how edgy the whole issue of Israel-Palestine made many in the Jewish and Muslim communities, and how emotional it could get. It was hard to come in and sort of have a rational conversation about it at a holiday event. So, much less any event. So he said, let's take the sign down. And the event worked out, kind of went on, but it brought up further questions. How far should a religious community go in sort of adapting itself to the needs of its guests or the views of its guests? Is there a line across which you cannot go? And he mentioned that there was a local hospital that had Jesus statuettes in each of the rooms, but when patients requested, non-Christian patients, they would remove them. Right, so they were trying to figure out, and so some of those sorts of issues that were emerging. So, that was one of the possibilities. But I think that issue is significant. Are there things that are important to do in terms of when you bring guests from another tradition into your community? Is there a line we will not cross? And I think we can, here, people are primarily Christians, so I think that's the context we have to take a look at it. We can't assess for someone else what they should put up or take down. What do you think about that? Are there things in a Christian religious community, a church, how far can that accommodation go? Can you think of things in your own setting? Yeah?
Actually, it's very similar. I'm not a church.
Right.
Valparaiso University's mascot is the Crusader.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And we're trying to expand our international reach, including to the Middle East, and that's kind of what we're
Well, not even just that. Jewish students from the Chicago area, from around, I mean, it's a nationally known university. Why can't anybody go there? It would be hard for a Jewish student or a Muslim student to say, I'm going to be a crusader.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What kinds of debates have been coming up around that?
The students have really, every once in a while, the students organize to do something, some students. And there's a bigger push right now for it. Although it doesn't seem to be getting any real traction. People are passionate about it from both sides. And so the group that's doing it is trying to set dialogues.
Right.
Instead of just saying, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong, there are forums that are being presented. But I think they've done a good job, but I just don't see anything changing.
Sort of any accommodations being made, or, you know, in terms of where the discussion is going.
Their interpretation is that the word crusader has become, people against the change have said the word crusader has been changed already. And that actually by being, having social justice kind of activities and outreach, that we will reform the word crusader.
But so, like, crusaders for justice.
Yeah, exactly.
But the mascot is still a little ugly knighted guy.
Yeah, that's the thing. If you were to change it into a protester with a sign, crusaders, you know, peace now, as opposed to a knight.
Right.
Yeah, you kind of, it's a little, that's like a perfect example and where people are willing to go. In terms of the arguments, people saying, well, this is, we want to keep it crusader, the term has changed. What are some other arguments for keeping it?
A lot of that has to do with alumni, really. It's a tradition. And the people who argue against that say, well, we already changed it once. During World War One. Before World War One, it was a German...
Teutonic Knights.
I forget what it was called. But it got changed right after World War One.
Oh!
So they kind of took the Teutonic,
more
generic.
Yes, exactly.
Just sort of a generic crusader against all infidels.
And then other people have said, look, other schools have done it, have come up with really silly mascots like the Purples and stuff like that. There's nothing to rally behind, and so there's a hesitancy to try to make it kind of meaningless to have a symbol.
So there's a lot, and so when you said alumni, the first thing that comes to mind then is dollar signs.
Yes, dollar signs.
A dollar sign, but partly because if there weren't dollar signs, and if alumni, especially giving alumni,
right.
get ticked off.
Right.
So yeah, which audience then, which constituency do you satisfy here?
Right. Yeah.
Is it your emerging markets of students, or is it the people who are funding? Yeah.
Right.
That's a tricky situation.
Yeah. And it's getting trickier because we do have an increasing number of students from Saudi Arabia and other places.
But you still got the situation.
You still have the situation.
Right. Excellent. And so in terms of trying to wrestle that, you're kind of in the need of a process to more fully talk about this. How do you go about talking about this without people becoming very angry right away?
That's right.
Right. Because that's the automatic, because that's what they were concerned with, this Israel sign right there. They said, yes, it's something we all need to talk about as a community, especially Jews and Muslims, but maybe this isn't the place and we need to be able to figure out how to do it without going from, you know, walking into a synagogue to, you know, a fight, you know. Yeah.
I was just wondering about the symbols that are rife in Christian churches and if any of the symbols are. And so obviously, there's at some point you can't, you don't turn everything over to a committee of what's politically acceptable.
Right.
But are there some symbols, since there's so many to choose from, are there some symbols that are offensive to the religious tradition that don't?
There's a lot of religious art, and there's a lot of writing done and analysis now of the depiction of Jews in religious art. Just
most
art generally.
Most churches don't have pictures of Jews.
But in stained glass.
Oh, in stained glass. Yeah.
Stained glass,
oh,
a lot
nice
of...
That's a church.
Yeah, that's a nice church.
That's not most churches look like.
Well, it depends on the location. You know, if you go further east in the tradition,
yeah,
you get a lot of that. I mean, there's a lot of that sort of, a lot of art in that way. Also, even on the covers of bulletins, people in terms of making Jesus the Aryan, because
yeah,
my kids have even asked, Mom, why is Jesus, was Jesus really that white?
Right.
And
exactly.
I, you know, and I'm like, no, no, you know, and they notice it, and they're little. They don't even know about all this stuff. And so, yeah, there's some of those sorts of things. So depiction of Jews in terms of it, whether it's a bulletin cover, any other, whether it's even an altar piece, maybe a painting. Because my church in decor is relatively simple, but they have a huge altar piece. And, you know, and a lot of times there's art and that sort of thing.
It may be a little bit different because I'm thinking in terms of secular, but I took my culinary training 5 years after I retired at Edmonds Community College. And a fair number of Turkish students on campus.
Mm-hmm.
And their instructions were on the grill, when those folks came through, you cleaned the grill and you cooked food for them that they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And they were quite clear and there was no discussion about it. It was just, these folks are here and this is what they need and want and that's what we'll do.
Like a dietary need, like
yeah,
somebody who was
yeah,
vegetarian, you know, or had allergies,
yeah,
you just kind of
yeah,
deal with it, like the whole category.
Yes, they had some halal meat for,
right,
for the Turkish kids.
Well, as long as concessions are being made in all the other areas of food, that it was treated just kind of matter of fact.
Yeah, the vegans got what they wanted.
And,
whatever.
And so in that situation, it could be, but the setting was a little bit more neutral.
State setting,
yeah.
not a church school setting.
School mascots are an especially touchy issue. I come from the town of Lowell, Oregon, which you'll need to get out your maps to find. It has about 1,000 people. My son goes to school there. He's entering fourth grade. The high school team mascot is the Red Devils.
Oh.
And they have on the wall of the gym a giant, glowering, bearded face in red with horns and a pitchfork. And a number of the more conservative Christians in the area take deep exception to being the Red Devils and don't like it one little bit. And there's a sort of an ongoing, simmering debate between the diehard alums who say we've always been the Red Devils, we're still the Red Devils, and the more religious members of the community who say we're not devils, we're Christians, and this is no good.
Right.
And they've gotten as far as changing the elementary mascot to the Red Rockets. The devil is still on the gym wall at the high school.
Okay.
And so these symbols, they carry a lot of baggage. And to come up with something truly neutral is difficult.
Right.
And there are always people who have an emotional investment in the existing symbol.
Right. And sometimes they're more offensive than other. You know, nobody ever went after. I went to the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. We were Wolverines. We were never accused of, like, stepping on territory. There wasn't a Wolverine society for the change of the name, you know.
Hugh Jackman.
I went to a men's college, Amherst, and they had to redo all their fight songs. And all their college songs when women became students there.
Yeah, because changes were made. All of a sudden you had women on campus and all the language was masculine. And there was no, you know, so you kind of had to, so concessions have been made. And that was a big fight and continues to be.
I think we need to do something about our sacred music or music like by Bach.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, St. John's Passion,
mm-hmm,
Matthew's Passion. They transport the whole anti-Judaism right along into the secular world.
Right.
And of course you can't change the music, you can't change the words there. But I think when they play it, they there need to be an extra something written out that tells about the context.
I think that's a learning opportunity. And I think art hanging in cathedrals and in, you know, the Vatican Museum, absolutely, those are learning opportunities to say, this is how at one time,
mm-hmm,
we portrayed these people. Now, some people might say, yeah, we still should. But other people might say, oh, that's weird. We don't do that anymore. Or maybe we shouldn't do that anymore. Or, I mean, I can't imagine getting rid of Bach. I can't imagine getting rid of Raphael. I can't imagine, you know, eliminating that because it's offensive to someone. Yes, it's offensive. Mm-hmm. Let's not be offensive. Let's, you know, move beyond that. Or again, talk about it in that time context of what was going on, mm-hmm. where it came from.
One of my favorite artists is Marc Chagall, and in the Art Institute of Chicago, he shows Jesus on the cross as a symbol of the suffering of the Jewish people during the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. It's really a moving piece of art.
Somebody who's kind of blended symbolisms and traditions there, but able to use them both powerfully from both sides. Yeah, Chagall is really an interesting case. In our worship settings, there's some things. No, we can't change it. We need to explain. How then, and yeah, if we're not going to empty out our museums and our conservatories, are there things that we can, that Christians can change? What my thought in bringing these two examples up from a hymnal and the biblical text, we're not going to get rid of the biblical text. You know, people have tried to come up with different versions of the Gospels that aren't as anti-Jewish. There have been texts, you know, all those sorts of bits and pieces, but they haven't really taken. We have these sacred texts, and they don't look like they're going to be, you know, sort of reconstructed. But is a piece like The Lord of the Dance with that line, is that something that Christians must have in their sanctuary? It's one of those things that Luther called adiaphora, which things are central to your faith tradition, critical, core, which things can you live without if you need to. He doesn't say adiaphora is worthless. He said which things are not necessary to your faith. So in my way of thinking, the scriptures are something that Christians will hold on to. All right? Lord of the Dance, with that line, perhaps it could be rewritten, is something that maybe they could tinker with. It's not sacred scripture. And yes, people may have memorized it and that sort of thing, but can that be adjusted? You're saying no?
But why? I come from a Catholic upbringing.
Right.
And I feel like from my Catholic upbringing, yeah, we kind of had a negative view about the Jews. I mean, it's not like I was preached to that I should hate these other people, but I then transferred into the Lutheran tradition, and it's like, oh, right, okay, so, and I also grew up, mm-hmm. you know, and studied history. And so when I hear Pharisees and scribes, I don't have this image, and maybe it's because I know Jewish people, maybe I'm just lucky that
it
way.
It makes a huge difference, because that's what I said, my students primarily get their images.
But if I was to have that in, you know, my tradition, I was working with, say, a youth group or something, I would say, let's look at this, and what do we mean by this, and how is that the same or different than what we live nowadays? You could change it. You could find other words that rhyme that would fit, but yeah.
And after all, Jesus and the disciples were Jews, not all scribes and Pharisees.
Right, but often that is not made clear in terms of the way we talk about them. That is not as clear. Most of my students, and these are educated students, are not aware that Jesus is Jewish.
Let's start there.
But most people, when I go to adult forums, people are still shocked by that. They think Jesus converted. Yeah, and I say, well, it's a little more complicated than that. But what I'm saying is, yes, in an ideal world, but given that, when real people's lives are at stake, are Christians, you know, in terms of what might we be willing to give on, how much education do we absolutely have to insist on? Other ideas about lines that, you know, kind of like what things are essential, which things can people kind of...
Well, when you're talking about people's homes and changing one line of a song, look at how many times the wording of the Lord's Prayer has been changed.
Right.
Like, I've read at least three different versions throughout my life just in the same church, you know, because they just decide to change the wording and use a different...
Update it,
yeah.
Switch it around. That's true. So maybe things like that. In changing the language of the Lord's Prayer, the idea is not to change the ideas behind it. This would be a little bit more radical than that. A lot of it has been to put the Lord's Prayer in language that people are speaking. But right, yeah, it's like, you know, in church I still find myself, which version are we praying? And be, so I got to make sure that whether we're doing the these and thous or, you know, that sort of thing. But you're right. We have the church has made changes to accommodate change in culture, change in language. Not always easily. Other sorts of, did you have your hand?
Well, I would think the biggest struggle in most churches would be with gospel lessons in particular, particularly a lesson from John, which very clearly hammered the Jews. And I don't think that most pastors are set up and explain, put that into context, because there's another message there. Mm-hmm. Not thinking about the anger and discrimination that there was represented in that, but they're thinking of the larger message of what Jesus is about. Now, what do you do? Are you ordained?
No.
Okay, well, but you probably have read the Gospels. What would you do what would you do if suddenly you had to read the Gospels at a church and there's one of the first passages in John that clearly hammer the Jews?
I do have some of those, and a lot of times I'm actually working on some articles right now.
Okay.
And taking a look at the passages I'm starting out with to focus on are the debate stories that show up in all the Gospels. It's when the Pharisees or the scribes or the Sadducees came to Jesus and said, and then with almost, there's only like two exceptions, they always get hammered and they always look stupid, and Jesus always comes out winning and looking much better, at least in the Gospel text. And so you have kind of like an us and them. Often the way those texts are preached traditionally has been, we don't want to be like those Pharisees. We want to be like Jesus. Not realizing that Jesus was a Pharisee.
Right, that's the irony, because Jews think of him as a Pharisee.
Right, and he was, in terms of his tradition, probably most closely aligned with the Pharisaic movement. So, but at any rate, you have this sort of thing. So what do you do in this dualism? You have to have one side that wins. It's either going to be Jesus or the Jews. All right? And what happens is there are a couple ways of preaching that. And often, the more politically correct way that I've heard more frequently now is, well, we are all Pharisees, you see. We're all kind of crummy. Let's all try to be like Jesus and not be Pharisees. So before, perhaps in Luther's time, because I've read Luther's sermons on the Pharisees, he called the Papists the Pharisees, as well as many other names. And, you know, that sense that you could, direct it towards the Jewish community. But today, but that still doesn't come across as very well, because you still have a winner and a loser. How can we recraft those texts to see in them more than a win-loss situation? And what are some rhetorical strategies for preaching those texts so you don't need a winner and a loser all the time? You know, and where you have, in terms of pinning it on certain parties. You know, and that's kind of, kind of where I'm developing some of those ideas, but a lot of it has been along the veins of education. When I've preached those texts, I do explain. But yeah, it takes a little while.
Well, I think of it now in a modern context of a debate among theologians, and one person's perspective may come closer to the truth and become accepted. Mm-hmm. And in that context, you don't disparage theologians, but you see, and this was an inter-Pharisaic debate.
Right. Most people don't know that.
Right. Again. But I would think, because I don't know how you do the winner and loser if you accept Christianity. I would assume that you, I don't know, winner and loser sounds a little odd, but that Jesus was closer to the truth. That's what you accept.
Right. I guess one of the angles that I'm using is that if you look at the Pharisees, if it weren't for the Pharisees, the scribes, the Sadducees, we would know nothing about Jesus. They're the only ones that ask him questions. Nobody else bothers.
The disciples ask him questions.
Can I be on your right hand?
Questions.
Informational questions. Where do we get our knowledge from Jesus throughout the gospel text? It is from those folks because they're the question askers. Isn't that, and it's and yes, occasionally the disciples do ask or say, we don't have enough to feed them. Where should we get our food? I mean, they're kind of mundane questions. You know, when you think about it. But yeah, how can we reframe these and look at them in new ways so that somebody doesn't have to lose, so that Christians can win? Do Christians need a loser in order to be Christians? Well, that's the question, and I think a lot of times we're answering that in very different ways. Do Christians have to have a? Does there have to be a loser if Christians, you know, to be a Christian.
The whole point of who goes to heaven. Mm-hmm. It's this point, right?
Yeah, and the funny thing.
Who goes to heaven? The winners go to heaven. What is everyone else?
I don't know.
Losers. I don't know.
They're losers.
But the thing is,
or
we don't.
Chinese.
The Chinese.
Or they're someone from another tradition that never heard of Luther.
This is tricky. Let's go back to this case study. What, do you think the rabbi made the right decision?
Yes. Yes, because he defined it. It was a political issue, not a spiritual issue.
So you're okay, just one question here. So it's good that he removed that sign, but we wouldn't remove, but Christians wouldn't remove.
If you want to call that political, I guess, I don't know.
Yeah,
how do you define it? Yeah. I mean,
well,
if I posted a group, or we were posting a group at our Lutheran church, and say the adult forum the coming week was Israeli-Palestine issue, what are we to do? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if it was a community event and we were inviting people in, sure, that wouldn't apply right away. I mean, if they come on Sunday and want to attend it, great, that's what we're doing on Sunday. But
okay.
I don't see that.
But you think you made the right decision because of the setting?
Absolutely. It seems so simple.
Is it that
Why
simple?
Why is it complicated?
Think about in that community, in the conservative, we didn't get the whole reaction of his community. Do you think everybody in that conservative synagogue was perfectly happy with that?
No.
What happened?
Were they there?
They heard about it. I want to write back to Harvard and say, we need that piece. Because they told me to send feedback. This is hot off the press. I'm piloting this stuff on you. And so they told me to send questions. Yeah, were you?
What about the concept of leaving a place at the table for Elijah, which is part of the tradition?
Go for
open and welcoming.
Open welcoming, right. Yeah, so that's maybe why they did it, the open welcome. But they wouldn't have taken down just anything in there.
One thing that interests me here I'm not sure about conservative Jews, but Jews are not messianic in the sense that they aren't they're not trying to missionize their
right.
faith. If you come, you're welcome, but unlike Christians who are evangelical, or most our Christian traditions are evangelical, we are actively seeking outsiders to come in.
Mm-hmm.
And so for Jews to alter their, well, that's not a word, well, it becomes an article of faith wrapped up in their experience. But I'm just wondering if for the Jews it was a little bit more difficult because they aren't looking for converts.
Right, they weren't doing it to appeal to someone.
Whereas Christians really are always
appealing. Yeah. In that, what might have been some of the reactions from, if you can imagine yourself for a moment as part of that conservative movement, that synagogue, you can be sure that rabbi took some heat at the council meeting. What kinds of heat would he have taken?
Well, are you afraid to say what we stand for?
Yeah, are we afraid to say what we stand for? What else? Any ideas why that would be so significant?
Well, taking down the sign may suggest that you're not supporting Israel. It's a negative statement rather than just the absence of it. It's removing your position rather than being neutral.
And some of this may be lack of in terms of how we understand what Jews think about the land of Israel. For many Jews in the United States, perhaps even most, even if they don't support, many American Jews do not support Israeli policies, but they support the nation of Israel. They see it as the miracle after the Holocaust. It is the star rising out of the ashes. It has religious significance. It's not just a nation. Many Jews see it as God signed the Jews that God's not finished with them.
But
now,
there's also a political thing that I met a fellow
but,
said. He always has tickets to Israel. He's got one-way tickets to Israel.
Yeah.
In case things go bad, he's going to go to Israel.
Exactly. So it's that sense that it's got theological, it's got a practical, it's a refuge. It's not just a political statement that they were making with we support Israel.
The more I think about it, it just kind of seems strange to me. The whole point of this seems to be an interfaith thing where we come together to learn about the other's way of looking at things,
right.
And they'll look at ours. If the goal is just to get along, let's go out and have a nice time together, then you don't have it at religious places, you don't do it over religious ceremonies. It seems the whole point of this is, come find out what it's like to be a Jew and help us understand what it's like to be a Muslim, and we'll show you what it's like to be a Christian. And Jews in general, in synagogues, are going to say, we support Israel. And Christians are going to have crosses up front.
Right.
And Muslims are going to have, they're going to have out their five pillars.
Right.
If that's going to offend you, you shouldn't be in an interfaith group.
That's kind of where I was going. I'm trying to figure out whether if he made the right decision, but that's kind of what I was like, can we provide an argument? If this is more central to being a Jew, not simply a political statement, but bigger than that, a bigger package, then should they have taken it down? If it is a theological piece for many Jews.
Even if it isn't, I mean, like, you know, yes, we would never take the cross out of our sanctuary because it would offend someone. I do allow people to move the baptism font if it's in the way, but I would not let someone move it because it offended them. But I would not want to go through my whole sanctuary and say, okay, this has to say that it's really important. This, if that's what you've got to do, again, you're just watering things down to the point that it doesn't even matter. We can't accept each other as we are, then we're not accepting each other.
That's what we're trying to hammer out. Where are the lines? Is there anything we should do at all? Or, you know, kind of...
I guess I feel it's not all about the totality of our faith. It's about parts of our faith that are patently offensive to us, like the Confederate flag is to, I would guess, African Americans. And, I mean, I have white kids in my school who fly that flag, and I have a long-running dialogue with them why it's offensive. Even though I have very few African Americans in their school, they don't get it. Well, that just means I'm a rebel.
If I know that's in your house and you invite me over, if you say, come have a dialogue with me about why I'm a white supremacist, I have a choice of saying,
right.
I don't even want to go there, pal.
But they fly it around the parking lot on their pickup trucks. And now that's a stereotype, but that's, or they wear it in their belt buckles or something like that in public. And I'm trying to explain why that symbol makes them others uncomfortable.
Yes.
Sorry.
I would say, not in conflict with Jim.
This is good. This is what we're trying to get, you know?
The description in here of how it was placed, there could be a lot of misunderstanding that sign was placed for this event.
Right. It looked like it was a temporary sign.
So it was on an easel. It wasn't like a cross that had been carved into the wall.
And I don't think any Jews would hide the fact that they support Israel. It's just, let's not put it in their face.
Right.
Like we're trying to convert the Muslims to support Israel during our interfaith event.
Well,
so
his argument too is about making the guests feel safe and welcome. And sure, at a later point, I can imagine they will talk about Israel and certainly even that night at dinner if somebody brought it up. I don't think they'd say, oh no, we're not talking about that, it's too political, but that's not the impression I got.
Right.
I think he was thinking more of the other guests.
And that's kind of what I'm getting at. This whole idea of interfaith interaction, these encounters, are tricky. And a lot of times it's like case by case. And we're trying to navigate this. We don't have a rule book yet. People have tried to do, what are the rules of dialogue? We'll talk a little bit about that. If we all live in a household, as Martin Luther King, a great household as our inheritance, and this is where we all are, every household has rules. What are the household rules, the minimum, that we need to do to encounter each other? Because, you know, and that sort of thing. So that's what I'm just trying to figure out. Are there household rules?
Don't provoke your sibling.
Don't provoke your sibling. So in this case, that would be it. And I do that. My kids, day in, day out. Don't provoke your sibling.
Hands to yourself.
Hands to yourself.
I understand the argument. I understand moving, so getting rid of the sign. But then they come back 3 weeks later for another event, and the sign is there. Mm-hmm. And you say, well, we didn't want you to see that last time, we thought we were going to offend you. But now that we're really close, let me tell you all the crap that we believe in. You know what I mean? I think you got to be who you are. You got to accept people for who they are. And if we can't fully accept one another as we are, then we don't get anywhere.
Up there.
What this makes me think of is, in our town we have an interfaith group, and the rabbi and the imam are really active in this, and they've been able to work really well together in this group. And then the Israeli conflict really blossomed up again this year, and the imam's brother or cousin was killed. And suddenly the imam and the rabbi were exchanging words, and it got really heated in our community. So, you know, even though that dialogue had already happened, you know, when you do just sweep it under the rug, it's still there. So, you know, I have nothing to offer to say what you do next with this, but clearly, the dialogue only seemed to go so far, and all the conversations that happened, and in some ways, a friendship, and it just disintegrated as soon as the conflict.
So in some ways, taking the sign down for that event, but then sticking it up again later, you're just sort of postponing it for niceness, or, you know, that sort of, yeah.
Well, I mean, I can kind of, if you put it in terms of a relationship,
right,
and you have two people that are meeting each other and going on dates, you don't put all of your bad stuff out on the laundry right away to let you know, let the other one know. I mean, if you just, it maybe it's, I mean, for some people, I think they think, yeah, let's just get it all out there, and that's their way of doing it. But then, I mean, they don't have a lot of second dates. But, you know, it's a gradual thing of, you know, learning about each other and then trusting each other, and then like, oh, okay, now we're able to go to that next step and next step. And
so relationship, it kind of goes back to what I was talking about yesterday, the definition of dialogue today, building relationships. Real relationships have trust. And if you have some trust, then you can air some dirty laundry, perhaps. Because then you have a situation in which you feel confident that you're not going to be rejected because of your dirty laundry.
Or you have a relationship enough so that you can be able to talk about it and say, well, based on what we have already,
and the person I know you are.
Yes, we can dialogue about this and then go from there instead of throwing it all out there before you have that relationship and other.
So this is who we are, take it or leave it.
Yeah, and then you go, if, you know, first this is your first thing that you see. Okay, fine, you walk away.
Right.
They're in relationship. I mean, this case study. This is an interfaith group. Right. They've done stuff.
They're inviting more. The thing is, it's a community-wide, so it's not just the 50 teams. They've been working together. Those teams have been passing by that sign that whole time in preparation. They're inviting their families and friends and neighbors to this who don't have that relationship. And maybe that's the key. Maybe that's the key, because these teams have been walking by that the whole time.
Ms. Manning mentioned earlier, what's the goal of interfaith conversation?
Yeah, what is the goal of interfaith conversation? It is tricky. A lot of people,
we're not willing to change, then that's all it's ever going to be.
Right.
And that's probably all it should be if we trust in what we believe in.
And if we're not willing to change something about ourselves, well, maybe even something core.
Sometimes I change, but I'm not willing to change, too.
Right.
I don't always go into these things assuming I'm going to make modifications.
Well, how much, why change? Why change? Just understand.
That's exactly it. If it's change.
Isn't there a balance in there, maybe, that we can try to understand, but not change?
Well, is that, can you learn at school without changing? Because that's what my students say. Yeah, I'll learn it for the test to get my A. But that's not learning. What is learning? What is to understand? If you understand something new that you didn't know before, you are necessarily changed. Perhaps not in the direction you'd like to have been changed.
Or real concrete in what you do believe in.
Right.
You know, when you've got to hear, you know, when you hear all sides, it gives you more faith in what you do believe in. But being open to others.
Going back to that goal, that is one of the things we talked about yesterday. We'll continue to talk about that. Originally, early on, dialogue was, at the, you know, 100 years ago, the idea was, we Christians talk to all these groups and they'll eventually come around to Christianity if we just be patient. Mm-hmm. That was the goal. Then it's, let's see how much we have in common. Maybe we have more in common so we don't have to kill each other. Or so that we can live side by side. And that was sort of, you know, status quo. It has now more become, yeah, what is the point of this? And now it's like the idea of dialogue as transformation, willingness to be changed, not always knowing what will be changed in you and in your tradition. The Diet Ek uses that term, mutual witness. Christians bearing witness to, and Christians having witness born to them.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Thank
so,
you. in my mind and head, I see the simple and the complexity of acceptance. Who we are, who we are. How wonderful to be who we are.
I guess I would hope if I went in, the change I would expect is a change in me. So if I go into a Jewish synagogue, my goal is not to figure out how they should change to make me comfortable, how I should change to be able to understand them.
If you should change.
And if you, let's say for a moment, going back to your original comment, which is very helpful, you talked about context. Let's say the Islamic community had been under fire. Do we take context into account in that particular thing? Where does context come in? All right, yeah.
Just, I was thinking along his comment, we're not talking about neighbors and neighbors, we're talking about siblings in the Abrahamic tradition. These are family feuds.
Family feuds, yeah.
They're always more.
One hand over here, yep.
I was just going to say, if Jim backed up a step, and he was now the Jewish community, and he is changing to make them more comfortable, then he might take down the sign.
Now, hopefully there's a place for humor in all these interactions. Like the man who looks into the woman's eyes, says, tell me, am I the first man you've ever kissed? She looks lovingly in his eyes and says, you could be, your face looks familiar.
You know, I think humor is at the heart of these interactions, and I think humor often is the one vehicle that allows people to move along. You know, sometimes, however, humor has been done at the expense of the other. Especially what my students, when I realized at Luther, as I said, many of them have never met a Jewish person, but they know Jewish jokes, jokes about Jews. I said, where'd you learn that? My mom, my dad, my grandma. They live in a little town in Iowa. And they're making Jews or jokes at the expense of. How can humor be made together so that we can all be part of it, you know? And that, I think, can be a very, very powerful, unifying, or at least ice-breaking sort of thing to develop those relationships.
But I would guess that those jokes are building. I would guess that the jokes that they know are derogatory.
Derogatory. Yes, they're always derogatory. And they don't even know what they mean half the time. But they use them.
Well, but then there are Old and New Testament lessons very clearly said I'm supposed to be, not necessarily tolerant, but I'm supposed to love justice, my brother, and treat him well.
Walk humbly.
Walk humbly. Maybe that's the point. If we're doing that, then this, you know, the dialogue's going to happen naturally for whatever purpose. I think one of the issues that I see is this America's trying to force everybody back into one church in many ways, our culture over the last 100 years. And maybe God wants us in different congregations so
what
we
do
don't fight so much.
America's,
I don't know. I shouldn't say that. The movement toward collaboration and unity, I mean, that's been part of the theme in 4 years as a Lutheran church. And we feel like we failed. Well, maybe those are things we can't resolve. I don't know. I can't go around and I'm not going to change the world. That's God's in charge of that. I'm just in charge of living well and according to
Well, you know, actually, and there are different views on what our role is to change the world. In the Jewish tradition, in many parts of Christianity, we are co-workers hoping to repair the world. You know, so even that is a place for dialogue.
That's their problem, though, from what you said, in their tradition.
No, I said in many Christian traditions.
Well, yeah.
Well,
that's a good place to start. Isn't that the core of this question?
Isn't that the core of this issue, the question whether we can accept that there are many ways to God, that we don't, that it's not us who have the one and only one.
Now, can we accept, and sometimes people are very anxious with the many ways language, maybe you can even step back from that and say, can we accept that God is very big and that we do not understand the infinite? You know, and so in before saying many, you know, that sort of thing, and that God can work in many, many ways. So in some way, you know, but yeah, and a lot of times it comes down to the many ways to God language. Lutherans don't go to God, though. Lutherans, in Lutheran tradition, God comes to us. We can't work our way or, you know, get there that way. So in some ways, yeah, so a lot
of
different...
We're not the only ones to...
Right. What is the opposite of, you know, chosen? Those are really important questions. What I think is so interesting about that, and I was kind of wondering how the flow of this would go. Everybody's had all these amazing comments all week, and I was kind of wondering, I thought, should we do this case study? It's not as controversial, but I think it hits closest to home. Because ultimately, if you're at the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport, you'll figure out how to get home. Right? National Day of Prayer, you don't have to go. You don't have to go. Most people don't. Statistically. But your kid wants to be in the interfaith team. She's got a really good friend who's a Hindu, and her boyfriend happens to be a Muslim. What are you going to do? Where are you in that? Where the conversation's already happening. That's when it hits close. Oh my, we're already got to get to vespers. Tomorrow we're going to try to do that sort of perspective, that where we're headed now, kind of like, let's think about this living in this household. What are some ways of thinking about it? Thank you.